Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Concurrent Management of Inflammatory Bowel Disease and Psoriatic Arthritis. I am Dr. David Hudesman, co-director at the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center at NYU Langone Health in New York.
I'm Dr. Jordan Axelrad, director of clinical and translational research at the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center at NYU Langone Health in New York.
In this program, we'll discuss strategies for managing coexisting inflammatory bowel disease and psoriatic arthritis, and the importance of a multidisciplinary approach to providing comprehensive care. To discuss more of this, we are joined by Dr. Jose Scher, Steer Abramson Associate Professor of Medicine and Rheumatology at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine, New York. Thank you, Jose, so much for joining us. Let's begin. Jordan, just to kick off this discussion, if you could just talk about extraintestinal manifestations in inflammatory bowel disease. How often are we seeing this? What are the most common types?
Sure. So extraintestinal manifestations are disease findings that are external to the GI tract in patients with inflammatory bowel disease. And in some studies, these are incredibly common. Up to 40 or 50% of patients may have an extraintestinal manifestation of their IBD, of their inflammatory bowel disease. These commonly involve skin, joints, liver, kidney, eyes, really any organ outside of the GI tract. Skin and joints tend to be the most common, which hopefully we're going to get into today. But these can be incredibly difficult to manage and may require expert consultation with colleagues in rheumatology or dermatology.
Right. So we're happy to have our expert here, Jose. So Jose, you know, on the flip side, you know, in your rheumatology clinic, how often are you seeing GI symptoms or something that concerns you? There might be something underlying, some type of subclinical bowel inflammation or IBD in your rheumatology patients, specifically psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis.
Yeah. Thank you both for the invite. Pleasure to be here. I'd say it's fairly common if you take the entire spectrum of manifestations. And by that, I mean, in general, we would see somewhere in the order of 5% of our patients with psoriatic disease and or axial arthritis, spondyloarthritis, having clinically overt IBD or concomitant IBD. The intriguing part of it is that up to, depending on the studies, but up to half of our patients do have a form of subclinical, meaning not clinically evident, gut inflammation, which may or may not manifest itself over time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's such high rates on both ends of the spectrum, the collaboration is extremely important. You know, and for us, we see some of that data as well, as Jordan was alluding to, especially when we're looking at arthralgias and spondyloarthropathies, you know, rates as low as 10% as to upwards of 50%. So, you know, when you're seeing a patient like that in your office, what's the usual workflow when you're concerned about any subclinical GI inflammation? Are you sending anything into the office? Are you referring to us right away?
I call you guys up quickly. Yeah. I think we do a very, we do a physical exam. We take the history that we know how to take. We're not super comprehensive, as you know. You guys have scores that you go through and, you know, screening methodology that you have more specifically, but we do a little bit of a cell protecting, an ASCA type approach of biomarker to discern whether or not there's something that merits a quicker referral, if you will, and certainly ask about the usual questions of bowel movement frequency, hematochezia, abdominal pain, etc. And so obviously we have these ongoing and smooth collaboration between our centers that is very helpful to us as clinicians, but most importantly to our patients, because we have this ongoing dialogue that's helpful for clinical care.
And Jordan, how do you ask about extraintestinal manifestations where you're seeing somebody in the office? Because I think we all do,
yeah.
Including myself, not as good of a job as we should.
Right. I think that it's probably underappreciated in the GI office, right? Mm-hmm. The actual magnitude of extraintestinal manifestations, in particular the joint and skin manifestations of IBD. I think are really underappreciated. And I think we're learning the right way to ask that. So what I learned from Jose is that I should be asking about back pain, which I now ask specifically about in addition to just joint pain, right? Because you want to know about spondyloarthropathy and axial involvement and whatnot. And that also influences maybe how we think about the right meds and also the right types of docs that they also need to see to be on the same treatment team as far as dermatology or rheumatology. So back pain has come into it, joint pain. And then, of course, I go into things like vision, skin, rash. Those are really the big ones.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a great point. Just when we asked, when I first started, I would just say, do you have joint pains, yes or no? Right. And then they're like, oh, no. And then they're like, oh, my shoulder, my back, you know, they'll just bring it up later. And I think, you know, we need to do a better job of asking these questions
right
in the office, because as you just alluded to, it's really going to affect our treatment decisions. Right.
Yep.
Now that we have more therapeutic options, you know, some that are more targeted, which might be good for one reason, but maybe not as good for patients with extraintestinal manifestations. So, Jose, let's say I have a patient, you know, asked about joint pains. They said their knee hurts, right? Or their back hurts. What other questions should we be asking as a gastroenterologist that could help, you know, us say, hey, is this something, you know, we should call our rheumatologist about or send some other test? Or, hey, it's somebody that's just sort of ran a few miles or they're getting older and it's just a little wear and tear.
Yeah, really good question, Dave. Patients with IBD, similarly to those with spondyloarthritis and psoriatic arthritis, tend to be on the young side. And obviously young is a relative term, at least for me it is. But we're talking about patients in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, right? And therefore, you eliminate right away more of the wear and tear type joint pain, osteoarthritis, and the like. So you really want to focus on whether or not this pain is secondary to trauma or exercising, right? A lot of people, particularly in New York, where we practice, are runners or do high impact sports. So you really want to know whether that's a meniscal tear or they be having some other trauma or micro trauma that would explain that particular joint pain. What we're interested in are symptoms of pain in a specific joint that associate with swelling, for example. Swelling is a huge one, right? If you have swelling and pain, that's more likely to be inflammatory in nature unless there was trauma to begin with. Redness, of course, and warmth are other signs leading towards a differential diagnosis of inflammatory disease. The third one could be a history of infection. You know, again, Northeast, and Lyme go together. So that's a good question to ask. Have you been bitten by one of these bugs at all? Or any other infections, Caribbean related trips where you have, you know, the viral syndromes like chikungunya, Zika virus, et cetera. Beyond that, I think we want to make sure that there's a screening process where not every joint pain equals inflammatory arthritis.
Yeah, Jose, what do you think about the patients that come in and say, oh, you know what, I wake up in terrible back pain or terrible joint pain, and then throughout the day, it starts to get better. Is that good enough to help differentiate between inflammatory and non-inflammatory?
I would say yes for the most part. And just for the record, what I was referring to before was peripheral arthritis.
Yep.
Right? Or every yeast, et cetera. Embedded in your question is this a lower back pain that's inflammatory in nature? And we indeed classify those as back pain that starts in the morning, typically someone who is 40 years of age or younger, that associates with morning stiffness of an hour or more. And as you pointed out, typically gets better or improves with mobility or exercise. Unlike, and that's the huge differentiating factor, if you had a slip disc, for example, or you had some sort of radiculopathy, that pain is there constantly. No matter what you do, you have a herniated disc, you will not get any improvement with mobility. Actually, you may worsen that pain because the slip disc will be in contact with the nerves that's being impacted by this leak. So those questions are very important. The fifth point on that discerning inflammatory back pain from non-inflammatory back pain has come up recently, and that is the use of NSAIDs. So if a patient says with NSAIDs you get better, then that's more likely to be related to an inflammatory process. The challenge there is that the new data doesn't necessarily show that. That improvement with NSAIDs, it's true for both inflammatory and non-inflammatory pain. So I don't think we're going to hold you guys accountable to that. And I will add that you don't use that many NSAIDs in your patients anyway. So there goes that one.
Yeah, no, I think those are all great points. And we, you know, need to do a better job taking that history, right? And that's just a couple extra questions, right? Separating joint and back pains, asking, is it better or worse with rest, right? And looking at their age. And then on physical exam, right? Like actually looking at the joint, right? Is it swollen? And so forth. So, you know, let's say we're doing this in our office, Jose, worse at rest, better with exercise. And when is this the right time to send them over to you? Should we be doing any other tests in the first place before sending them over to you? Is there a specific time that you think's best?
Look, and when we've collaborated in some studies trying to understand, you know, how to screen inflammatory back pain in those kind of patients, I think that for the general practitioner, if you can, this is a very straightforward and linear imaging test, and I'm referring to sacroiliac joint x-rays, plain x-rays. And the reason for that is that that's very helpful. We're going to do that no matter what in general. So if you have that patient whom you suspect inflammatory type back pain, you could help us and help the patient accelerate or expedite the workup by doing the x-ray. The reason for that is if we find any images that are representative of sacroiliitis, then we're done. We call that patient radiographic axial spondyloarthritis. So we're done with the assessment. I understand that it's hard and you may not want to order the wrong x-ray, but this one in particular is very straightforward. Sacroiliac, dedicated sacroiliac joint x-ray. You can't go wrong with that. Any radiologist would understand that order. Other than that, I think we can do a quick visit and then think about whether or not the next level of imaging studies are necessary. And I'm referring to the MRI.
Yeah, Jose raises a good point about the MRI, right? Because our patients with Crohn's in particular get these very often. And many of our radiologists may even comment on the SI joints. And we may not be looking, as a gastroenterologist, we may only focus on the GI components. But that's important.
Yeah, maybe Jose, if you want to comment on, and we could discuss a little. We had, we had a collaborative publication looking at this. Exactly what Jordan's saying, looking at our MR enterographies that we have already for Crohn's, and actually going back and having our radiologists actually take a little closer look at the SI joints.
Yeah, fascinating study. That's one of those where we have made really good use of our collaborations, right? You guys do MREs, you look at the inflammatory component in the intestinal lumen, but as a freebie, if you will, as an add-on, you could look at the sacroiliac joints, the same area, right? And it's using MR technology. So we went back and found that somewhere in the order of 20% of the patients you see with Crohn's will have MRIs consistent with sacroiliitis, which is a magnificent way of screening those patients for not necessarily clinically active or symptomatic, but yet concomitant axial spondyloarthritis. And that's important because treatment is not necessarily the same. As you were alluding to, Dave, if you have a patient with Crohn's disease with axial spondyloarthropathy, we have all these new biologic treatments that may or may not affect the spine, for example, the peripheral joints.
Yeah, it's a great point. And now, you know, from the study, our radiologist specifically, right, and it's not that big of a deal, our radiologist now specifically comments on the SI joints, right, in the report. And it was sort of a request we have. And again, there are other tests you can do, but that's something easy. You already have that information. You're not spending more time in your office to get that. So I guess, why don't we pivot to that, Jose? It was a nice transition, looking at approaches to therapy. So maybe start with sort of psoriatic arthritis, right? And when you're thinking about treatment options for your patients and what you would go to regularly, let's take out IBD for a second, and then we could bring that back in. And Jordan, let's hear sort of your thoughts on sort of how we approach it with the concomitant diagnosis.
Yeah, great question. You know, similarly to the IBD field, psoriatic arthritis patients present in a heterogeneous fashion. And so it's not a linear, you know, one size fits all type therapeutic algorithm, if you will. To us, it's very important to understand the intensity or activity of the different domains. It's not the same to treat someone who has a lot of psoriasis in their skin or someone with a lot of joints with little psoriasis. So I'll take you through two or three scenarios. If you have a patient that presents to you with severe active both psoriasis and peripheral arthritis, we tend to use a drug or a medication or a set of medications that can help both domains. And by that, I mean an IL-23 blocker, for example, or an IL-17 blocker, because those are superior in some ways to the TNF blockers when it comes to psoriasis of the skin. If you have a patient with mostly arthritis and little psoriasis, to us, a TNF is the go-to mechanism, still is for a variety of reasons. It has been for the last decade or decade and a half, and it would seem to me that it will continue to be the go-to MOA or mechanism of action because of the advent of biosimilars. Then we have patients that present, as we're discussing, with axial or spine arthritis. That complicates matters because there are not that many drugs or options. We're limited to a TNF or an IL-17 blocker in general. And then after that, we have the JAK inhibitors that are being approved for the use in axial spondyloarthritis. So those are the three main scenarios. Purposely, I didn't comment on the presence or absence of IBD, but I'm hearing that you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, so Jordan, let's throw in IBD there with an extra intestinal manifestation, so skin or joint.
Sure.
How are you approaching those patients?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of really important considerations. So what I'll say is that in IBD, we don't have IL-17 inhibitors, right? These have actually been associated with some flares of IBD, and so we don't have these of treatment options, but are sort of academically interesting for patients who develop GI symptoms on these drugs. That's almost a separate, you know, a chat in and of itself. You know, similar to what Jose said, a lot of times if there's axial involvement with inflammatory bowel disease, anti-TNFs, again, tend to be the therapy of choice that seem to benefit both. I think when there's psoriasis is present in psoriatic arthritis, in particular with peripheral arthritis, I think that's a good indication for the IL-23, IL-12-23 inhibitors. That seems to have pretty good coverage. Now, of course, if a patient has disease severity of their IBD, that makes me want to use an anti-TNF or infliximab, I'm still going to use that in that patient. But I think we have some data that suggests IL-12-23 and IL-23s work really well for that patient. And then, of course, the JAK inhibitors, which are not yet approved in Crohn's but are approved in moderate to severe ulcerative colitis, just another option for many of these folks. The other really important scenario, and Jose, it'd be great to get your feedback on, are for the patients who develop psoriasis while they're on IBD therapies, right? This is a different patient in and of itself, right? So not the patients who come to you, treatment naive, joint pains, new diagnosis of ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, but patients who we already have on therapy who now develop a skin manifestation. What are you thinking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. It depends. It depends on what's the background regimen. And we do this all the time with both centers, right? It really is dependent on what the patient's being treated with. If, in general, that may occur for two reasons. One, the medication that's being used stopped working. Two, something to consider is the paradoxical effects of TNF blockers, for example, right? We have those patients not uncommonly. It's not hyperfrequent, but it's there. So you got to consider the possibility that some of these patients develop psoriasis secondary to a TNF blocker. In those scenarios, whether there's a secondary inadequate response what is the paradoxical emergence of psoriasis? We do switch over or try and think first of an IL-23 or IL-12/23the absence of axial arthritis. So if it's peripheral arthritis, for example, or no arthritis at all, but you have a patient with IBD on a TNF that develops psoriasis, we tend to switch to a 12/23 for obvious reasons, right? 12/23 or 23 blockers are exceedingly efficacious in psoriasis. We all know that. And so because they work as well in IBD, then that's the immediate answer. You know, could you switch from one TNF to the next? Yes, you could. We typically avoid that. We switch classes.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. Earlier literature before for IBD, before we had ustekinumab and risankizumab, now are 12/23 and 12/23, we would switch, right? And maybe certain TNFs had lower rates of reaction to have right. another psoriasis form reaction, but it's still a chance. And maybe just, Jose, just maybe briefly comment on how does that psoriasis usually present? Is it differently, you know, is it than a regular psoriasis if it's from a TNF?
Oh, I see. So paradoxical, not in general, but not uncommonly, more frequently, it presents as either palmoplantar psoriasis. It's not infrequent. It could present as plaque or gouttate. It's the minority of cases. And therefore, we get a hint that on someone who either never had psoriasis to begin with or had a different type of psoriasis presenting with palmoplantar lesions, we tend to suspect that that's paradoxical in nature.
That's a great point. I just want to, and then one question. So we always discuss, you know, or we are discussing now the difference between IL-23 and an IL-12/23, right? And we don't have great data yet to say that one is, you know, necessarily better than the other, or they're equivalent. In rheumatology, do you lean towards one over the other? So would you lean towards an IL-23 inhibitor over ustekinumab, and why?
Yeah, unlike you guys, and by you, I mean the IBD field, we moved away from the 12/23. We and the dermatologists as well. They're just simply a P19 blocker, a pure IL-23 is simply superior for skin and joints. And there's data for both, more for skin than there is for joints. And the 12/23, we actually never used the drug, because it's the only one in the market. I don't think we've ever actually used that drug the way you or the dermatologists have. And that's true if you ask the company, they will tell you that the rheumatologist never went there. Because, and it's true, the joint response for 12/23 is not robust. There are patients that are on it and respond well, majority won't. So that's the why we like the P19s now.
Yeah, I mean, well, up until recently, we only had ustekinumab right. in our field. And so now we have risankizumab, you know, obviously brings something different to the table. For sure. And I guess one of the more challenging things for us, Dave, and it'd be good to get your perspective, is when we have a patient who's had very severe disease of their IBD and are finally well controlled on maybe a dose escalated anti-TNF therapy who now develops a psoriasiform reaction. You know, is that someone that you think about switching therapies, adding therapies, or what do we do here?
Yeah, so a great point. And I would say most of the time, right, usually the IBD disease burden, right, is more of a significant inflammatory burden than the joint or the skin usually. So if we're saying that this is a sick patient, right, fail multiple therapies, maybe past surgery, whatever that is, I think we had touched on this before, it's all about efficacy and keeping them in remission. So if I found a therapy that's working for them and they're doing well from their IBD perspective, my goal is to keep them on it, right? Now we're gonna, what is the severity of that psoriasiform reaction? So usually if they're doing well on something, if they could be treated with topicals, right? Or some use, right? You could have these mild reactions, I'm keeping them on their TNF. Right? It's only, I need to be pushed. And this is my view on a lot of our patients with IBD, especially our more complex patients. If I have them well on something, I really need to be pushed to stop, right? So look, I've had these patients at that exact scenario, right? Where they have, you know, significant scalp psoriasis and they're just, we can't, right? I have to get them off of it. Then we'll talk about it. But in those scenarios, I do whatever I can to stay on the TNFs. And then depending on the severity, those are the patients where I think JAK inhibitors are going to play a nice role. And we do need some more data on that. But that's where I think we might lean towards to cover both.
Yeah. If I may interject, I think it is exactly what you're saying, Dave. It is the burden of inflammation. We do the same in arthritis. Someone who's failed so many other drugs in the past, and we finally got them under control, we typically don't switch that medication at all. The dermatologists, our friends and colleagues, have multiple tricks that they can use. It's topicals, it's UV light, it's a little bit of cyclosporine. There's plenty of things that they can do. Now, I'm not going to talk about clinical management, but there are clinical trials right now ongoing where the question is in patients, particularly early in the game, is there a role for combining with a second targeted agent? And again, for the sake of this discussion, this is not clinically available. But a study such as Vega, which you guys know very well, combining a TNF with a 23. Or in our case, we have a similar design. It's the trial is called Affinity. This is on someone who fails actually a TNF. Would the addition of 23 in psoriatic arthritis would be better than a 23 alone, switching to a 23. So intriguing times, you know, those sicker patients are important for that particular reason. It may very well be that we get to the combination on those that need it the most.
Right. You know, and we've had a lot of discussion on combination therapy just in our practices and how we use them. And EIMs, I think, is a perfect scenario where we're starting to do that just, you know, by necessity. But I think we need to be more thoughtful in how we use combination therapies. And then something you had just brought up about how we haven't really seen that benefit in the IL-12-23 is for joints. What's your experience with the selective IL-23 inhibitors with joint symptoms, joint swelling, and so forth?
Yeah, as I said, I think I referred to that, it's a step up compared to a 12-23. It really is. The clinical trials show that. Early use compared to a second line doesn't really make a difference. That's also an advantage where you can use it as second line and it's still efficacious. The downside is the spine, as discussed. It doesn't seem to work on the spine, and therefore we avoid the use of pure 23s in those scenarios.
Great. And then I think, you know, just want to get your, you know, final thoughts on sort of the appropriate way, if we're seeing a patient, when we should refer, if you're seeing a patient, when you're reaching out to us. And it really sounds like from everything we're discussing, from IL-17s maybe leading, you know, to possibly leading to flares of Crohn's, to side effects of certain medications of our therapies, to sort of the selectivity of our therapies. Really, we want to do this before, right, we start. But sort of how does this workflow usually work in your practice?
In general, again, to me, the key here is to have a fluid, smooth relationship and communication channels open with, in this case, you guys and the dermatologists, where you could truly either pick up a phone or send a MyChart note and say, here's a scenario. Can I take 3 minutes of your time? I've done, you know, fecal calprotectin and it's borderline. Do you think you want to see this patient or you want to wait? You know, I think that communication is missing in some areas of the country, geographic regions, that is. And so the more we can do to incorporate those channels of communications to other practices, the better for our patients. I think we, secondly, I think educating on the role of combined care will be very important. And embedded into that is the question of screening. What can we do to help screen for IBD? What can you do in the IBD world to screen for joints? What will we discuss? And then again, having a third leg here, which will be our friends, the dermatologists, because we have these other EIMs that are so relevant to our patients. By the way, the patients are an N of one, right? Their own statistics. And so if you only treat the gut or the joints or the skin, you know, we're losing time, we're not communicating, we're not making anybody any favor.
Any other thoughts, Jordan?
I think the collaboration is really key, and working with the team, of course. And then I think as gastroenterologists, it's important that we recognize our limitations. You know, we're not dermatologists, we're not rheumatologists. And so it's not good enough if patients are really struggling despite being on a therapy that we think is directed for their IBD. If they're still experiencing active psoriasis, active joint symptoms, they really need to have expert referral and collaboration to improve care.
Yeah, I think those are all great points, right? Early collaboration is key. Finding those people in your area,
right,
that you could reach out to, that you could shoot a text or email on thoughts. And I think what we could do better at gastroenterologists, just a couple simple things, are asking those questions, right, about skin, about timing of when these skin or joint symptoms started around medication, asking that separate question between joint and back pains, asking about whether that pain's better or worse with rest and exercise. I think those are some, asking our radiologists to sort of take another look at the MRE, look at the SI joints. So these are very simple things we could do as gastroenterologists that I could really help, you know, hopefully diagnose or at least take these patients and get them over to rheumatologists so Jose and his team could help out. But I want to thank you, Jose, for joining us. This was a great discussion. Thanks, Jordan, and we'll see you soon.
Yeah, thank you,
guys. Jose.